10 minutes for discussion, and we're actually on schedule, you know, in this panel. Comments and questions? Yes.
I'm Surajit from India. My question is to the whole panel, but particularly to Professor Bhaduri. That is, sir, what is your opinion about land reform and land distribution, particularly in a gender-sensitive manner? Secondly, I think, sir, I mean, since you are very closely related with the ground-level politics also, I mean, you have seen in your eyes, so that way I just wanted to know that to have substantial changes in the policy direction, what is the role of political mobilization in this? Because without change in balance of class forces in power, can we really have a very progressive kind of policy framework? And thirdly, I wanted to know regarding this profit growth and productivity growth related to that. Now, if there is a trade-off between unemployment and productivity, then would you suggest that we should control productivity growth or technology, maybe in terms of shifting of investment from so-called more profitable, more productive sector to comparatively less productive sector? Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting presentations. I have a question for Indira. You cited the five aspects, or you proposed rather, the five aspects of social protection. I just wonder what should be the order of priority. Of course, priorities could be set by country to country, wherever the country's social protection framework that might be. If we are to suggest some certain reforms or to introduce social, you know, certain social protection policy framework, because I think, in my view, income security, in my view, should really be the first priority, followed by health and so forth. But you cited the unemployment insurance first. I do not know what you meant. That was supposed to be the first priority. So this is just a question I have. And then another question to, this is for Professor Bhaduri. I just would like to ask, you mentioned the labor productivity should not be used for reduction of cost by the company's operation. And as we all know that the wage share of the overall profit across, in fact, it's the overall, I think there's hardly any exception to this case, has been diminishing. And that's very much related, I think that's really also very tied to the whole phenomenon of increasing inequality across countries and within countries as well. And I think there is a reason to believe that the how the financial sector has been behaving has a lot to do with it. In other words, companies need to reward not only the top management, but also to continue rewarding the, you know, investors that invest in the companies to deliver higher profit gains for those investors. As a result, wages have been really compressed in terms of the share of overall profit of the, you know, the companies. And in my view, that was the reason why I did ask this question in the on the previous panel, whether there should be any kind of oversight on profit distribution. Of course, that's probably total, you know, it's a fundamentally against quote-unquote capitalism, I should say. But it's also because I think this is quite critical because, as I said, the, you know, the production system is getting more and more decentralized. Companies certainly dislocate production site from one country to the other simply because production, especially the labor, is cheaper in certain XYZ number, you know, the countries. So that really, I think, increases the pressure of race to the bottom in terms of the wage, you know, the what the laborers should get paid, you know, in terms of wages. So I'm probably making more comment than a question, but so I just stop here. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much, the presenters. I have I think it's a clarification. Probably I didn't hear the measures, the options that Indra, you were putting forward in terms of social protection. I'm not very sure whether I had cash transfer, or maybe you said it since I'm having only four options, but the issue of cash transfer is what is being promoted at the moment by the donors. They are advocating for cash transfers to mainly vulnerable groups or families who have got orphans. Of course, my reservation there is, of course, the budget, whether the budget can be sustainable. And I think I'm risking going back to the old economics, but it's my reservation. And then the issue of microfinance. The problem really that we've been experiencing in many countries are the interest rates of these microfinance companies. They are so high. Mm-hmm. And and actually it's under NGOs. It's NGOs who are mostly providing these microfinance credits. In terms of administration, they tend to be ruthless, you know, with failure to pay. They give you a loan, and then like every 3 days or something, you are supposed to be giving them, you know, they give to a group, then every 3 days they want you to be paying something. And if you do not comply, I mean, they are really ruthless. They can take your property, but you can imagine if an NGO is supposed to be helping the poor, and then that same NGO goes and begins to get a bed and a mattress, you know, from the poor households, then you begin to question the very essence of NGOs. Of course, not all of them, but I mean that is the practice. So. I'll apologize if you have talked about the cash transfer, but even if you have talked about it, the issue of the administration is very important. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please. Over at the back.
Thank you. Again, my congratulations to the panelists. I'd like to ask you about mechanisms for the monetization of labor that is not normally monetized, especially concerning the last presentation. I think, of course, we know that there's very important work out there that is being done without being considered as a currency. So what would be the mechanisms concretely to make that happen? And related to that, how could information and communication technology support gender equality and pro-poor policies in that regard? We hear examples of mobile technology, we hear examples as to how internet is supporting that, but I don't see it really being mainstreamed. So my question would be, in your view, in view of all the panelists, if there are mechanisms that could concretely promote that. Thank you.
Thank you. Indira? I'm sorry, Mariama? Yes.
I wanna, I think, maybe interject two things in a discussion. One is a kind of interesting process that's taken up space, or, and it's been growing in the U.S., in terms of linking to what people are calling the third sector. Businesses that are socially responsible, that are focused around ensuring employment and housing, among other issues that are not directed so much as private property, profit. And there's a sense in which there are like 13,000 businesses in the U.S. that are publicly traded, yeah? And there's about 8 million that are private corporations or private businesses. And increasingly in some communities, Chicago, Detroit, some parts of California, there's been an alliance of some of these socially responsible businesses with public policy interests in terms of buying up foreclosed properties, putting them together as a community land trust, and then seeding that back into communities. So there, you have an option as a local government that you have a range of housing. You can make your tax reform policy such, or your policy such, that foreigners, or you could sell the land, on, the houses on eBay. But there are groups of businesses who are coming together, buying the houses along with municipality, fixing them up, but not putting them back into the private domain, but actually selling them to community groups at nominal fees, nominal monthly fees, with 99-year lease provisions, which they can actually pass on through families. And so that's been one sustainable way of trying to, and it's occurring in Chicago, where people are going and buying up blocks of houses that you can now get for ridiculous amounts of money, and trying to turn these into community land trust process. That is an example of one way, I think, creative way of dealing with this issue of land reform. So there are many ways. I think then the other issue I want to throw in is something that is occurring in some Latin American countries, and increasingly in some areas in the U.S. are trying to experiment with it, which is when a factory or a business entity proposes to close, in many cases the workers are staying in and refusing to move the equipment and so forth. And I know in Peru and other, and in Argentina in during the crisis, some municipalities overrode property rights to give those factories to workers and provided public policy subsidies to enable workers to be able to maintain those enterprises. And so increasingly in some communities, that's been pushed in the U.S., you know, that workplace democracy or cooperative or whatever you'd like to call it. So part of this, what's emerging or what's being conceptualized as solidarity economics or the solidarity economy or the social economy is a growing network that's actually interlinked with employment, housing, but also currency, the creation of community-backed currency. And in many cases, for-profit industries such as Citibank and other banks have been involved in these community trusts and also involved in some of the community currency provisions. And large corporations have also been involved, like Staples and others, are participating in this. So there's lots of creative things that are occurring. There's some aspects of it differently expressed in South Africa, in Brazil, in Porto Alegre. In India, there's a solidarity economy or a social economy network. Now, I don't know how pervasive or how huge they are, but what I'm saying is that they are creative alternatives that social movements and quite a number of economists are beginning to try to conceptualize some of these initiatives as, and they've been existing, it's just that they've been ratcheted up because of the crisis. A lot more people are opening up to it. And so what it does is I think it complements the last resort phenomena. It also opens up public policy to a different way that you may be able to look at public policy. And it's certainly in Brazil, in Porto Alegre, in Peru and Ecuador, some municipalities are actually focusing public policy around it. The clearest place I know of in North America is actually in Montreal, in Quebec, where the local government actually, maybe 40-50% of its public policy is around supporting these kinds of entity. But what I'm saying is that they're comprehensive, is that if they're not just focusing on employment, they're actually all inclusive, trying to ensure housing, employment. If you want to do business, it's not anti-business, but it's a socially responsible business, the kind of business where labor productivity is not geared towards capital, but it's geared towards enhancing community growth and development. So they're actually utilizing some of this.
Mm? Okay.
All right. And I think it's worth looking at for some of the...
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I wanted to point out that in their public policy and public policy advocacy, they're actually using the Levy Economic Well-being Index, plus that approach to a basic income grant, which maybe these cash transfers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's some creative uses going on with them.
Thank you. Maybe ask the panelists to try to reply. You want to start? Yeah. Amit, you want to start and we just go down the line? Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'll answer only the specific things. The first question on land reform, well, of course, it's... You see, land reform very briefly has two dimensions. One is whether it is between men and women, there is more or less land would be divided when the... According to the current Indian laws, women should get share. Very often, this is not operational. Okay, so land reform has a dimension which is completely different in North India. Much of North India, that is, women are entitled to land, but they actually don't get cultivated land. They don't have the right to that asset. Land reform also has not a gender, but a class aspect in terms of poor and rich, people with more land or less land. You know, I think basically we should be able, and this touches on, I'll come back to this in a minute, the whole question of the nature in which we look at property rights, both in simplified Chicago kind of economics of property rights, as well as in Marxian writing. Property rights are treated as far too simple a concept. And I think actually things like community rights, which did exist very often, traditional usury rights. Many of these things in the case of land reform, like in the case of India for the, you know, for the tribal communities and so on, actually those are the things which should be much more promoted and at least should not be allowed to go die down. It is another matter the government is going exactly the opposite way. But this is something which we should, you know, land reform is a slogan which is to land to the poor. That is, I think, just too simple. In the Indian context, it would not work like this. We can discuss this later, but I think we should be able to look at land reform or property rights in general as a far more complex issue where use rights, traditional customary use rights, very largely should determine what it is your actual use of property rather than who owns it and gets an income from this. Now, on the question of political mobilization, transfer between, you know, productivity and employment, there is a straightforward economic answer. There is a percentage growth in productivity should be not less than the percentage, you know, 1% growth in employment should not lead to less than 1% growth in labor productivity. Then your total productivity, total output will go down. It's the elasticity measure. But actually what you really require is something quite different. And that is what she was hinting at, if I may say so, but through specific examples rather than the general principle. And that is also the principle in which I believe, you know, is the only probable way in which we can go forward to some extent. And that is, you see, what in America and so on, I suppose, is called the community. We have a similar system in India, which is a legal system. That is at the local level of villages and so on, you know, elected local bodies and so on. The panchayats, the gram sabhas, and so on. They should be actually given the power, you know. And once you give them the power to choose the projects, they will not choose local projects, which are actually the most productive one. Because they are not going to export the fish they produce. They are not going to export the rice they produce. They are going to produce it for local consumption. And I put it theoretically that, you know, we should break the link between productivity and cost. But you will basically have a system if you go to some extent, give the power to the community to decide. You will actually turn towards a system were much more productivity looked upon as a way of creating goods for local consumption, I mean, not goods for creating profit. The problem arises, and this is one of my biggest problems with globalization, is you cannot do this, particularly in a poor country, if you are producing for exports. The kind of goods which you produce immediately rules out 60% of the population. You know, whether it is clothing, whether it is housing, I mean, whatever it is, you rule out simply 60% of the population, which is just too expensive. That is what a poor country is all about. And this is, and you also cannot produce those goods without the help of corporations. You cannot even, and this is where actually you don't have to fight corporations by saying that, you know, we'll tax you, so on and so forth. You simply try to push more power to the local communities, more economic power to the local communities. And much of the, I believe, quite a bit of the industrialization abnormalities in poor countries will take care of itself. I don't want to take more time.
Thank you. Indira, please.
I would like to start by saying that I'm talking about three basic rights, human rights. One is right to social protection against vulnerability, right to education and health, and right to food. These are the rights which must be provided irrespective of whatever your policy framework is. That's a major thing. And in that context, I think that these rights need to be provided. I didn't discuss the finance part, but I would like to add one very important thing, that even within the given constraints of the domestic financial policies, fiscal policies, there is considerable space for spending on these things. First, you know, we are giving how much subsidies and incentives to the corporate sector to grow? I mean, it comes to a significant percentage of your government expenditure. Secondly, when you are spending on health and education, the elitist approach is to spend more for higher education, tertiary kind of health services, and so on and so forth. So if you improve your composition, if you don't subsidize them as a part of your strategy, and then, of course, one has to think in terms of special taxes, which can impose on the people for specific purposes. And, of course, deficit financing is very much there. And if you are using employment rights, then short gestation period could also be useful in controlling inflation and so on. And so within the given space also, there is considerable. So that's my second point. My third point is, you know, the mad rush for capital-intensive technology for exports arises from the growth model, because that's a policy framework which you have selected for yourself. But this link can be broken if you go by right-to-work approach. Because if you go by employment guarantee approach, massive employment generation, then you focus more on infrastructure, basic services, and on environmental resources, regeneration of environmental resources, and so on and so forth, which in the context of developing countries would help in diversifying agriculture, promoting agriculture growth to start with, diversifying agriculture, and diversifying into non-agricultural sector. That means it will promote an industrial model which will be different from the export-based model, which will be based on wage goods, which will be based on internal demands and so on and so forth, which will expand employment opportunities and which will expand consumption levels on a broader basis. And lastly, what I would like to answer some of the questions. First is about social protection, composition of social protection. It is something which depends on the country concern. But yes, one can think in terms of giving health high priority as against employment. Depends on your, because, you know, if you are employment, unemployment is high in a given competitive environment, then unemployment insurance becomes very important. So it depends composition, but some basic package is there which should be treated as a right of workers. That is my one point. About second point, microfinance. I think I fully agree with you, because the way we are planning to finance women's groups and poor group, etc., is a very dualistic approach. You think of microfinance for them, expensive ways for financing for them, and then institutional finances for the corporate sector. So that must be broken, and that's why I said institutional finance should be available to small enterprises and women's enterprises, etc., through setting up a fund. Because they are not willing to give, banks don't give easily to these people, and particularly those who are affected in crisis. So you have to think in generating a fund which provides finances to these people. And I think two small points. One is about this mechanism, I mean, the innovative experiment which Mariama is talking about. In fact, there are many more innovative such experiences in other areas also. Private-public partnership is one area where a lot of experiments have been done. Production, cooperative of producers or poor is another model which is coming up in a big way. There are a large number of institutional innovations, and I think they are most welcome. If you can integrate this with the well-being of the workers or the poor, all these innovative experiments are most welcome. And one small point is that when you talk of land reforms or land to women, it is not just through inheritance. It can be also given through redistribution. For example, if you are having wasteland, you can promote cooperatives of women. If there is surplus land from land ceilings or something, or if there is some kind of R&R policy where you have to give land in compensation of losing land under major infrastructure project, that land can also be given to women or joint ownership, etc. And of course, the last is sale of land. If you allow them loans and subsidies for buying land, that also could be one of the means of doing it. So land rights to women can be given in multiple ways. I think I have covered almost all the questions.
Thanks, Indira. Rania, are you going to take up this monetization of labor?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, please. Yeah.
Would you like to say something?
No, 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 no. It's just that it's an unanswered question.
Okay. First, a word on labor. Labor is hired because it makes profits, period. So when labor is not generating profits, it will not be hired. The only alternative for that labor is, it has been proposed that those laborers should become entrepreneurs. Borrow, set up your own business, and try to provide for yourself. That is one approach. The other approach is that you cannot have 80% of the population being entrepreneurs, and if this has not happened in many developed countries, we shouldn't be pushing it down the throat of everybody else in the rest of the world. So, if labor is not going to be hired, the question is, in addition to all kinds of other arrangements of cooperatives for the poor, of guaranteeing access to land, etc., employment as a right should be there. That's as simple as that. The reason is exactly what Amit was saying earlier, that this becomes a way to mobilize labor that actually you are not stealing away from the market, but the market makes available to you, and you are mobilizing this labor in an alternative framework of production, essentially, that is not profit-oriented, but if and when planned well, it can create assets, it can create services that are based on satisfying needs of communities that go unmet for a variety of reasons. So that is the first point about labor. One word about cash transfers. I think I will start sounding like a tape recorder any minute. Because cash transfers and employment guarantee programs should not be thought of as competing alternatives. You can have two members of a household that are working in an employment guarantee program and are still not securing, for a variety of reasons, because the program is designed wrong, because who knows why. They are not meeting the living standards that should be humanely acceptable. The government can either give cash or provide the services in kind. So in order to survive, you need a combination of things. And the proposal should always be that we avail ourselves of all possible channels, because what we're thinking about is a social wage. It's an expanded notion of income. You don't only have income from the market or only the cash transfer, but a combination of these. Monetization. The question that the gentleman asked back there earlier. Well, it is, I would say, the first thing, the first step is socialization of unpaid work. The monetization can come about either through commercialization, where the market starts providing the services and you just buy them. So instead of taking care of your own children, there is childcare available, you take the kid to the childcare center, you pay for it, you have monetized the process. The other possibility is socialization, where it becomes the responsibility of the government. It is a government provisioning. It is raising the next generation and providing all of what is needed at a very early stage of development, at a later stage of development, to children. Now, this is not a revolutionary idea. Not all countries do it, but you can look to Sweden to see that this happens from the time that you're born until the time that you die. It used to be called the welfare state that provides for the needs of the citizens. And the last point I want to make is on Mariama's idea about what you were saying, Mariama, about housing. Completely in agreement. There isn't one shoe that will fit everybody, right? But the point is that in response to housing, I think we have to have a comprehensive housing policy. There was such a thing once upon a time even in the United States, and that space has disappeared. Now, in South Africa, they do use, actually, part of the Expanded Public Works program to build public housing, to build ecological latrines in places that sanitation is really a problem. So it can be, labor is supposed to be mobilized to fulfill community needs, not a top-down build roads from here to nowhere, not dig ditches. And again, this is to be thought of as part, not the solution, but as part of the policy menu that is available to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like to close the panel now, and I think we had a very productive discussion and quite interesting points have been brought up. So can you give one hand to all the panelists and to all of us? Thank you.